United of Columbia in history and sociology, an MPhil from Cambridge, and his PhD was in history and philosophy of science at Pittsburgh. I ought to say, for those who don't know Pittsburgh very well, that that is one of the leading programs in the world in history and philosophy of science. It's truly exceptional. And Steve is the author of several books. I don't remember them all. I think it starts with social epistemology, philosophy of science and its discontents, philosophy, rhetoric, and the end of knowledge, then science, the governance of science, ideology, and the future of open society, Thomas Kuhn, the philosophical history of our time, knowledge management foundations, and Kuhn versus Popper, the struggle for the soul of science. He's been a very busy man, as you can see. I can tell you something very personal about him. I consider Steve to be the most interesting historian of intellectual historian of ideas, concerning that part of history of ideas which has to do more with science. I'm saying this on the basis of reading his Thomas Kuhn book of Thomas Kuhn, The Man of Our Time. I took it with me on a holiday last year and it made my life. Look at my exceptional book, the exceptional book, a very thick book, but it's exceptional. It also happens to be very witty, sometimes a little corrosive, but very, very witty. So, and I also read his smaller book on Kuhn versus Popper, who is also. One Thomas Kuhn I recommend to anyone. It is an exceptional intellectual history of the last half of the last half of the 20th century. As a matter of fact, I'm sorry that John Gray could not be here teaching here in Tennessee. I invited him to come because I think, however opposite those two men are, they make a pair. Steve is to history of science what Gray is to political science. So it's just a pity that he couldn't come. Well, now, with this, I'm very anxious to hear. We are all, I hope, what Steve has to say.
Well, thank you very much, Victor. The reason why I'm here has to do with the publication of this black book, The Intellectual. And one of the things that I say in the introduction to the book is I thank Victor and this institution for sponsoring some very important aspects of public intellectual life in this country today. And I think it's important to draw attention to institutions like this at the outset because there is a tendency to conflate, see intellectual life, you might say, in one of two ways. Either a very kind of caricature, stereotyped way of the bistro Bolshevik kind of French person who wished they were in 1917 in the Russian Revolution, or on the other hand, just an ordinary academic. Right? And both of these stereotypes are wrong. I mean, there's some overlap, of course, but they're not identical. And I think the purpose of writing this book, The Intellectual, was to sort of try to get a sense of the mindset of the person who's the intellectual, who may be, someone who's sitting around in cafes all day, and maybe someone who lectures for a living, but doesn't necessarily have to be either one of those. And I think this institution, given the kinds of people who are brought in to speak, and the sort of people like you who are in the audience, who I'm sure represent a wide range of walks of life, this is what public intellectual culture is about, ultimately, okay? So it's a great pleasure being here again to talk about this topic in a very explicit way. The year 2005 is quite interesting in its own right, and this is something I bring up at the very end of the book, because this is the 100th anniversary of the birth of two of the most important intellectuals of the 20th century, and that is Jean-Paul Sartre, who was born on June 21st, 1905, and Raymond Aron, who was born on March 14th, which is next Monday, I believe, and 1905. And they have actually quite similar educational backgrounds. If you know about the French system, right, if you're going to be anyone by the age of 50, you've better been at the same place at the age 20. And they were there. And so very similar kind of background. So they're coming of age around 1930, let's say. They spend a little time in Germany, both of them, before World War II starts. Aron picks up a lot of the stuff going on in sociology, having to do with Max Weber, and Sartre picks up the stuff having to do with Husserl and Heidegger in phenomenology, which was very big at that period. One of the things that's quite interesting about both of these figures is I'm not sure anymore whether people in the audience would know who they are. They were very important. You know, I said they are two of the most important intellectuals of the 20th century, and certainly of the second half of the 20th century. But they are people who, in a sense, are not part of the canonical corpus of any particular academic discipline. I mean, in a sense, you can sort of imagine them having had influence at various points on things like philosophy and literature and sociology and politics and all that. But if you say, well, where's the lasting trace? Right? It's not clear. It's not clear, for example, what department you would go to if you wanted to study these guys in any more detail. And it's not because they didn't leave a large paper trail. These guys wrote voluminously. They were writing all the time. They were writing scholarly books. They were writing for newspapers. They were very famous in their own day. But once they died, they sort of disappeared or gradually faded into oblivion, or sort of got their views subsumed under other people, for example. So, you know, in the case of Sartre, a lot of what he was talking about gets kind of easily assimilated to Heidegger, let's say, who is more the sort of canonical figure in philosophy for talking about similar matters. And in the case of Aron, right, because he wasn't really a neoconservative, but he certainly wasn't any kind of, you know, left-wing socialist, so where does he fit in? It's not clear, so he kind of disappears too. Okay, and this is not an uncommon fate for intellectuals. All right, and in fact, if you look at sort of the great intellectuals of history, and if you go a little further back from these guys, you look at somebody like Bertrand Russell. Okay, you go further back and you look at somebody like Emile Zola, right? Who, of course, was in his day seen as a great sort of pioneering novelist, but who reads him? Who really studies him very much in literature departments? You go back to the Enlightenment and you look at people like Voltaire, Diderot. I mean, really the only person from that period who survived in any kind of canonical form is Rousseau, for the social contract, for that is to say, a relatively small part of his work, and that's in political philosophy, not in general philosophy or epistemology or metaphysics or anything like that. And again, look at Erasmus in the Renaissance. Look at Peter Abelard in the Middle Ages. Right, and we go back to the ancient times and you look at someone like Protagoras, the Sophist. And what I've just done here is going backward here is I'm giving you sort of, in a sort of very sort of abbreviated form, sort of what the history of intellectuals would look like if you really sort of emphasize the people who are important as intellectuals. Okay, and they don't fit very neatly into any kind of disciplinary category that we recognize. And this has a lot to do with what intellectual life is about. And in a way, the degree to, and this is the thing you might say that very much concerns me, because I'm a professor of sociology, okay? And I've been a professor of sociology for 11 years now, and I've been an academic all my life. And the thing that's very striking is the degree to which, you know, the demands of being an intellectual and the demands of being an academic pull against each other. And this has been a sort of constant theme in the history of intellectuals. So, for example, you know, we look at this institution here in Bath, and who's, you know, the intellectual that immediately comes to mind is Joseph Priestley. Okay? And Joseph Priestley, right, who was associated with this institution and this city for a lot of his very fertile period when he was working on scientific matters, he is, in a way, epitomizes the problem of trying to get a grip on what intellectuals are about. Because, like all intellectuals, this was a man who had a very kind of holistic vision of things. Right? He's a dissenting Protestant, right? Very strong religious beliefs, very much concerned that people get the interpretation of Jesus right, for example. But at the same time, this is very intimately connected with certain kinds of views about how the mind works. So he's a very active proponent of associationism in psychology, which he believes actually does back the theological views that he's promoting. He's also very much involved in scientific research. Moreover, and you know, you're probably most familiar with him with the sort of controversies over the discovery of oxygen, which he called deep logisticated air. Okay, and again, why did he stick to this sort of seemingly now, from our standpoint, outdated notion of phlogiston, the fire element, literally in Greek? Why did he do that? Well, that's to be understood in terms of all these other larger concerns that he was worried about. Okay, he wasn't somebody who was trying to establish chemistry as a scientific discipline with a firm foundation in the way that, let's say, his opponent, Lavoisier, was. Lavoisier was quite explicit about saying, we're going to put chemistry in a scientific foundation, and this is the way we're going to do it. We're going to have these elements, and this is going to be how it goes. But Priestley's interest in these experiments that led to the discovery of oxygen was not to establish any kind of narrow scientific discipline, but to contribute to a sort of larger metaphysical picture of how the world worked, which would then enable individuals and society as a whole to reach salvation. Right? So there's a really big picture going on here. Okay? And it's a picture of human perfectibility. And so there's going to be a certain way of interpreting these experiments that's going to be integral to that. Now, this is an incredibly sort of, you might say, very holistic, very large-scale view of things, right? And in fact, even in his own day, Joseph Priestley was very much criticized as someone who couldn't, focus sufficiently, right? He didn't really do the experiments quite right. He couldn't understand the technicalities Lavoisier was going into, and he kept on seemingly moving from one subject to another and not really, you know, being able to acknowledge what Lavoisier was trying to tell him. Well, that's because Priestley was really playing a much bigger game. He was playing a much bigger game. It was one that had to do with metaphysics, with politics, and with science all at once, because he's trying to come up with a sort of worldview that one can live with in all its different registers. In other words, he was not committed to the idea of science or scholarship as a sort of segmented part of life. Okay? He wanted it all. He wanted integrated. This is not to say he pulled it off, of course. And in fact, a lot of historians who are very much interested in 18th century thought, right, spent a lot of time trying to figure out, well, exactly what was this system that was sort of in the back of Priestley's mind that they never quite got together? Right? I mean, this is, you know. But the point is, there was something there. This was kind of motivating. And if you look at the great intellectuals, there's always something like that going on. And one of the consequences of that is that there's a sense in which the works of these people tend to appear, no matter how big they are, you know, Sartre certainly was not afraid of writing enormous books, they always seem to be just part of something else. They never seem to be complete in their own right. They don't seem to actually be contributing to something very clear, except some kind of vision that never quite gets articulated. Okay? Because there's a sense in which what the intellectual does is the intellectual intellectualizes the life process. That's kind of what being an intellectual is. Okay? And so what happens then is that the legacy of these people who we regard as intellectuals comes across, you might say, as a kind of aroma, almost, right? A kind of attitude that's associated with these people, rather than any kind of specific propositions or statements. And you can say, oh yes, Sartre believed X as opposed to not X. Very hard to pin intellectuals down on exactly what they believed, but you can get a sense of kind of what's the manner, what's the attitude, what's the style, what's the aroma, what kind of a mind are we talking about here? That's generally the level at which we can talk about intellectuals once they're gone. Whereas with a lot of other people, of course, especially in the sciences, we associate them with very specific kinds of contributions, right? X is a theory. X has come up with some discovery, right? We can put their name to it, and they get a Nobel Prize for it, and all the rest of it, right? But with intellectuals, no, there's just this kind of whiff, right, that they sort of leave behind once they're gone. Because in a sense, you know, they are what it's about. Right, their interventions, their being there, and all these different occasions where they're writing and they're operating in many different registers at once. That's what it is to be an intellectual. And so from the standpoint of a world where in retrospect we cut things up into academic disciplines, intellectual doesn't really fit anywhere. It sort of disappears. Okay? And of course, you know, when we think about things like, you know, the history of everyday life, which is kind of the way in which we normally think about public culture these days. Right? We have, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that per se, but that way of framing things at the outset doesn't really naturally lend itself to talking about intellectuals. Because intellectuals aren't ordinary people. Right? I mean, whatever else they are, they're not ordinary people. In some sense, you might say they speak for ordinary people. They stand for that. They're sort of like, you know, the ideal ordinary person or something. You know, the ordinary person, had they the leisure to think things through clearly and weigh all the different possibilities, that's who the intellectual is. But that's not actually the empirical ordinary person. So when one does a sort of history, a retrospective kind of, you know, cultural studies account of ordinary life, intellectuals can disappear from that too. Okay? So there's something, there is a real, you know, writing a history of intellectuals is a very challenging kind of enterprise because, of course, we can sort of imagine who the people would be, but then telling the story in a way that has a coherent narrative, I think, would be very difficult. Because in a sense, these people are both, they're at once in and out of their time. Right? Because in a sense, they have a very large vision, they're trying to sort of make a point that in principle could stand for eternity, but they're doing it by intervening on a regular basis in lots of different issues. And one of the consequences, of course, of this kind of way of operating, and this applies just as much to people like Sartre and Aron as it did to Joseph Priestley or any of the other people who I've mentioned earlier, and that is, these guys change their minds a lot. Right? They're, you know, with regard to a specific kind of issue, are they for or against, right? On most issues, they will probably be, especially the more abstract the issue is, they will at some point have been one way or the other. Now, to be sure, one of the things that in a sense marks intellectuals in terms of their integrity is that very often, I mean, I think this is in fact characteristic, they stand against the dominant opinion. Okay? And they stand against the dominant opinion often, you know, regardless of what you might have expected them to say prior to that point. So, for example, you know, when we think of people like Sartre and Aron, we think of Sartre as kind of a very left-wing guy who was kind of, you know, remained a communist long after it was popular. And Aron as a guy who, in a sense, was sort of ahead of his time, that we think where we are now is progress. Because, in a sense, he was one of the earliest French defenders in the post-war period of the sort of Anglo-American kind of liberal democracy kind of view of things, okay? And he was also one of these guys who believed the whole idea of a nuclear holocaust was greatly overrated. He turned out to be right, but people at the time thought, you know, he was just being a little too cool for comfort, you know, a little too rationalistic, you know. So the thing is that, so there are all these differences between Aron and Sartre, but in terms of specific kinds of issues, very often they stand against the dominant tendency together. So, for example, both of them were in the French Resistance. Okay, they were both in the French Resistance. And also, both of them were defenders of Algerian independence. Okay, and in both cases, they were going against the governments of their day. And it's very characteristic of intellectuals, right? And so they're not, there's a sense in which they sort of judge the issue on its merits, right, on the basis of principles that don't, that can't, in a way, be assimilated to some kind of political party line or something like that. There's a sense of intellectual responsibility, to be sure, but it's one that's sort of transcendent of all the normal categories. Sometimes these guys articulate it, sometimes they don't, and so this is what leaves it all very mysterious. You know, because if we have a kind of view of the world where we sort of have a clear sense of, okay, what's all the right things to do, we expect that people will have had a kind of principle that's pretty easy to figure out that's guiding them along the way. But if it looks like they change their mind, even though they're going against the dominant trend, then we wonder what's going on here. Are they just capricious? Are they just, you know, as it were, trying to be provocative for its own sake? And this is something, of course, that intellectuals are always accused of. Okay. especially when they're sort of ahead of their time. So there's a sense in which being an intellectual is a very challenging kind of enterprise, and it's a very unloved kind of enterprise. I mean, there's a sense in which, you know, for those of you who attempted to follow this kind of life, right, I mean, you know, it looks great at a distance. But then, you know, if you read something, for example, like the autobiography of Joseph Priestley, because Joseph Priestley lives, you know, he sort of, you know, in his mind, he thought he was a kind of important guy. And so he wrote this autobiography that sort of went pretty close to the end of his life. And it's quite an interesting thing to read, because it doesn't really tell you all that much about his ideas and like, how they all hang together, but it tells you something about how people responded to him. And, you know, this is a man whose house was always being burned down, who eventually got driven out of Britain and, you know, spent his last days in the United States. You know, I mean, this guy was always getting in trouble for anything he said. And he's always being criticized and all the rest of it. And, of course, you know, like all intellectuals, he has this kind of ethic, whatever doesn't kill me makes me stronger. Right? And this is, again, very characteristic of the life of the intellectual. Now, this is where the issue of the academy comes in, right, the university. Because there's a sense in which the university ought to be the breeding ground for intellectuals. For a reason that's related to what I've just been talking about. Namely, that at least until quite recently, right, academic posts have been institutionally secure. Right? In the United States, where I'm from, we talk about tenure, right? The idea of lifelong appointment, right? Something that originates with the German reinvention of the university in the early 19th century, which America picked up, and was sort of a kind of default pattern across the world until we, you know, sort of got into the grip of neoliberalism after the end of the Cold War. And now, increasing numbers of positions are temporary positions, right? So academics, in a sense, you know, it's harder and harder to actually get a job where your life's income is guaranteed. But back in the old, good old days, right, there's a sense in which this ought to have been the breeding ground for intellectuals. Because here you are, right, you know, you have this kind of lifelong appointment, right, where you're allowed to teach and research in whatever, you know, drives your curiosity, right, and you have the classroom with a kind of captive audience to try out the ideas, sort of make the new discoveries publicly available, at least in a small scale, to go out elsewhere. And the thing that's so striking is the relatively, relatively little advantage that people, academics, have taken of this opportunity that existed, you know, for at least 150 years. You know, and if anything, when we talk about the great intellectuals, they're often people who were sort of cast aside by academics. Even though academia, in a sense, should be the ultimate breeding ground with these lifelong appointments to pursue inquiry wherever it leads. Okay? And that, of course, because if you can't, because the key thing here is, right, you want to be able to say unpopular things that people will condemn you for and will, you know, say you're talking rubbish and maybe even show that you're wrong, but nevertheless, you can go back the next day and still have a job and still teach. That is the ideal institutional condition for pursuing the intellectual life, because you will then have the kind of security, the kind of buffer that will enable you to actually strike out boldly. Because the problem is, at the moment, the way the academic world is constituted, right, where you have an enormously large percentage of people, especially among the younger generation, who are on short-term contracts, how do you orient your research? You orient your research to what's going to get money. You know, even if that's not the primary concern, you're always very preoccupied about the various peers in the peer review process, what they think, because if they don't publish your article, you're not going to get promoted and all the rest of it. And so you spend your whole life second guessing, you know, the people who are deemed your superiors. And of course, the thing that is incredibly pernicious about this is the amount of time that academics have to spend in this kind of state of purgatory, right? Because the longer you spend in it, right, the more likely at the end of it you're going to identify with it, okay? And that is a real problem. Because it wouldn't be so bad if you were like on a sort of, you know, where you were on a probation period, where people are going to check you out to see whether you're competent and so forth, and then afterwards you get a permanent appointment, and that's only like 3 or 4 years. But the problem is people are going through a succession of short-term contracts. So that often, you know, if and when they get an academic appointment, they're in their mid-40s, okay, which is not uncommon these days, right? Then what kind of a person are you at this point, having gone through that kind of system? Are you someone who's just ready and willing to go to challenge the status quo? Not at all. Not at all. Okay? If anything, you're prepared to reproduce the system that you have become successful through. Okay? And so in this respect, academic life today, the way it is constituted, is in a certain way actively discouraging the kind of boldness of intellectual life. Okay? Now, this is not to say that academic life, you know, that academia isn't the place for breeding intellectuals. Of course it is. So, you know, whatever you take away from what I'm saying today, I'm certainly not saying that universities have nothing to do with intellectual life. But in a sense, it's kind of a byproduct, right? It's not a direct consequence of what it's doing, okay? So you have people going through the system, and they are picking up stuff, but they realize, you know, people who have any kind of intellectual boldness start to realize, look, I'm not going to get ahead going through this system where I'm going through a succession of short-term contracts where I have to kowtow, you know, to every sort of, you know, mediocre, you know, professor who happens to be at the university. I'm not going to be able to get anywhere this way. It's anything very provocative. I'm better off going into some more formally public medium, whether we're talking about television or radio or newspapers or magazines. And see, one of the things about Britain that I think is very distinctive in comparison to the United States, let's say, is that in the 1980s, when you start to get a sort of larger cohort of people coming into universities, there weren't a lot of academic jobs at the other end. And so what this meant was that a lot of people who in a sense had academic aspirations initially were sort of forced because of labor market considerations to sort of find work elsewhere. And these are the people running the production companies of you know, sort of various television and radio things. And it's one of the consequences is that there's now a very high level, I think, of public intellectual life in this country being conducted through the media. And these are basically people who have strong, you know, have academic training, formal academic training, and very often were frustrated in their academic careers, and so have found these other media as ways of expressing what led them there. And as a result, you get these very provocative programs. I mean, again, if you're an American, you know what I'm talking to. In Britain, people can easily take this kind of thing for granted. But if you're an American, you know. Things here are very intellectually provocative, very imaginative, okay? Even the stuff that gets trashed is very imaginative. And it's not by accident. The people who are doing it are people who know what they're doing. I mean, about 5 years ago, I think it was in The Guardian, the business section, there was an article about academic backgrounds of people who were running all the major TV production companies that were feeding Channel 4. You find out these are people with degrees from Goldsmiths College, almost all of them, you know. I mean, they all have some kind of cultural media studies, you know, sort of thing that from an academic standpoint look a bit, you know, sort of like blue blood academic credentials, but they're not in academia, okay, for this kind of work. And not surprisingly, they come with all this very imaginative stuff. So what you see, in fact, today in Britain is you see kind of a continuum, you might say. So, of course, you've got stuff at the low end, right, and everybody's always thinking, this, right? But it's a continuum. It's not a sharp divide. It's a continuum from the academic side to what you might call the low end of the sort of media culture. And so there's a kind of intellectualism spread throughout. Okay? And for the most, and this is, has a lot to do with the fact that the people who are involved in it are academically trained people. So it's not like academia is having no effect on intellectual life, but its primary effect is not within academia. Because in academia, we live in a state of captivity. Okay. And the main reason why we live in a state of captivity in academia is because the way in which we assess intellectual work is kind of a house divided against itself. Because when the whole idea of tenure and all of these kinds of, you know, these sorts of institutional features of academic life, the kind of permanent lifelong appointment that encouraged people to actually pursue the life of the mind wherever it led, the presupposition of that institutional framework was that you do this research that's very cutting edge, and then you teach it. And there's a kind of natural cycle there, okay, in the sense that the research, of course, will initially always be novel, a discovery, cutting edge, right, against the grain. But in order for it not to remain esoteric and not just something that can be kind of a power base for a certain kind of cult, what you'd have to do is you have this obligation to teach it. And in fact, this would be kind of the primary means by which you would display that you have in fact come up with some sort of knowledge. It would get into the curriculum. It would be part of what people learn. And through that mechanism then, it would disseminate through the society and would be part of the sort of, you know, intergenerational dynamism whereby each new generation gets a new form of knowledge that's appropriate to its time that constantly enables people to be on the cutting edge of things. Now, what that requires is that research and teaching be seen as integral to each other and that people are rewarded for bringing the two things together. We do not live in this situation in academia today, especially in this country. Okay? Now, those of you who are academics will know that we have two completely diametrically opposed ways of evaluating research and teaching. Now, I should say at the outset, I have nothing against evaluating universities. And have nothing against evaluating academic work, especially when we're talking about something that's publicly funded. Okay? Taxpayers are entitled to know what's good, what's bad, what's up, what's down. There's nothing wrong with evaluation. But evaluation has got to be intelligent. Okay? And at the moment we have evaluative mechanisms that are in fact destroying the intellectual life of academia. And that is because research and teaching are pulled against each other. So we have research being judged in terms of these peer-reviewed publications, the more the better kind of thing, and they have to get cited a lot by other peers, and so it's a kind of self-reinforcing process going on there, right? So in a sense, your audience for the research are other people kind of doing what you're already doing, okay? So that completely eliminates the students or anything more public, right? So in a sense, you're being encouraged to get more and more esoteric. Now, the teaching, on the other hand, has to do with, well, how many students do you have? Do these degree programs lead to credentials that enable these students to get jobs, right? And, you know, it's a customer satisfied kind of mentality. Now, that has nothing to do with the research agenda. Okay, so we've got these two kind of diametrically opposed things going on here. And not surprisingly, of course, what we're seeing in Britain is that we're getting two diametrically opposed kinds of universities developing, right? I mean, this has been happening over and over again through the various iterations of the cycle of this evaluative thing. And the overall effect is not only, the overall effect is to destroy the integrity of the university. And to destroy the integrity of the university means to destroy the university as a place where intellectual life can happen. Because at the end of the day, if you want to talk about, you know, no matter how, some of you who are academics, and I certainly run across this a lot, you know, academics say, look, they say about themselves, I'm not ready for prime time. I'm doing this kind of, you know, research, which I think is quite important, and I think it's going to do some earth-shattering things, but I'm not the kind of guy who can go on the radio or go on television or, you know, write a 500-word column in a newspaper or something like that. But traditionally, at least, you had a classroom. You had a way of actually, you know, where you're in a situation which is not as daunting, right, as being, you know, on a radio with 20 million people listening to you, right, but, you know, it's one where you kind of come in there already with a presumption of authority, where you can be kind of comfortable and present your material, where the students are already there because they figure you know what you're talking about, so they're sort of receptive, and so there is an opportunity for you to actually develop a kind of public voice in a relatively sympathetic environment, which is what the classroom is to a professor. Okay? And that is being pulled apart. That is being pulled apart. And so as a result, academics are no longer encouraged to develop these public intellectual skills in the environment where it would normally happen. Right? Rather, they are being encouraged to write, primarily, not speak, and I think, you know, we reach a very important point. is kind of the coin of the realm of intellectual life, there is going to be a problem with it going out to a lot of people. Because when we talk about writing, we're primarily talking about certain ways of displaying competence and authority. Okay? Speaking, and I mean speaking, not speaking in the sense of reading a piece of writing, but speaking like what I'm doing to you now. Okay, we're speaking in quite clearly an alternative medium to writing. Okay? That is a much more public medium, but it is neither evaluated nor rewarded. Okay? And in this respect, you see, academic life is really moving away from treating the kinds of stuff it does as ideas. I mean, one of the things I talk about in my book, and it's something that in a way took a while for me to dawn on me, is, you know, at the end of the day, intellectuals take ideas seriously. And in a sense in which, well, what does that mean exactly, ideas? Well, if something's an idea, it has to be conveyed, in principle at least, in multiple media. It can't just be something that can only be conveyed one way. So in other words, if you don't understand the language I'm speaking because, you know, I have this sophisticated education, jargon, blah, 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 then forget it. That's not an idea. That's a show of force. That's a show of power. That's a way of using language to create distance, right, to create hierarchy. And of course, that is incredibly familiar. Indeed, this is one of the reasons why Socrates didn't like writing. Because prior to ancient Greek, if you were to think about where writing was happening, it would be in these kind of news boards that would be in the various Near East empires or in Egypt, where there are declarations from the king about what is the case. Okay? And in a sense, academic communication is being encouraged to move more and more back into this direction. And indeed, you know, of course, you know, we do have academic conferences and stuff like that. And then, you know, so where we do speak to each other, it's not academics don't speak at all. But when we do speak, right, there is a premium put on reading the written word. Okay? And the written word, and when people have to ask questions, you know, answer questions from the audience, right, if you're sort of in a fix, you say, well, isn't the longer version of the paper? Right? Or you didn't hear me properly. Let me just reread this incomprehensible sentence to you a little more slowly, and maybe you'll get it. And then by that time, you know, the questioner is totally intimidated. Okay? And again, we've got this use of, you know, writing, you know, through speech, but basically writing being used as a vehicle for enforcing authority. So when we talk about the whole business of an idea being conveyed through multiple media, we don't have to talk about great pyrotechnics here. I'm not talking about massive television production things necessarily. I'm talking about the difference between writing and speaking. That is a major multimedia shift for academics these days. And the point, and this is why, you know, I say in the book, and I've said this in other places where I've been writing about the business of being an intellectual, is that if you do have an idea, if you have an idea you want to get across, in principle, it should be possible to get the idea across through a wide variety of media and in, you know, virtually any space and time. I'm not saying this is going to be immediately apparent, okay? But, you know, so for example, if you go back to the early 20th century, and, you know, Einstein comes up with relativity theory, and everybody says, wow, this is an amazing thing. It defies common sense. It violates what Kant said with the a priori conditions for space and time and all the rest of it, and this is like some amazing challenge. I mean, you've got to be a PhD in physics to understand relativity theory, right? Now, Einstein's a total genius. No one could ever come up with this kind of thing. Well, you know, give it a century, and it's part of ordinary physics curriculum, okay? And there are lots of ways of representing it, okay? And my publisher, Icon Books, has Introducing Relativity, which is all in cartoons, okay? So the point is, it's not, you know, it's maybe not immediately apparent how a sort of seemingly counterintuitive, complex idea can be portrayed through alternative media, but give it time. That is, in fact, part of the public intellectual process, is the translation of the idea from the original media in which it appeared into these other media. Okay? There is nothing, You know, and it seems to me that once we actually take this on board as a serious enterprise and actually reward people for doing it, you know, so the people who are able to translate these seemingly counterintuitive deep ideas into multiple media so that other people have access to them, you know, once we take that kind of thing seriously, right, then, for example, I think we will come up with a much more democratized notion about knowledge and intelligence in society at large. You know, so for example, you know, why do we call Einstein a genius? You know, just using Einstein as an example. Well, because of, you know, the sort of break he seemed to have made with taking for granted notions of physics, right? And we reward that, right? As if, you know, as if we're this new moment of mystification is the thing that ought to be rewarded. The fact that now we've got this idea that, you know, gets rid of all the other ones and hardly anyone can understand it. Cool, right? I mean, this is not what public intellectual life is about. This is a case in which knowledge is used as a basis for power. And this is why, over time, it's very important that this kind of original insight be distributed, be disseminated, be popularized, right? So that it then becomes part of the common intellectual life. And again, this goes back to my original point about the business of how academia traditionally did that. Namely, you do the research, you come up with the original ideas, but then you have a classroom where you are forced to translate this to an audience that doesn't already know this. And you're doing it in a reasonably sympathetic environment. So it's not as threatening as going on, you know, Radio 4 and talking to 20 million people. Okay? And this is the thing that's in fact being pulled apart today and destroying the intellectual life of academia. Okay, so this is the kind of thing, I mean, one of the things that I've been doing myself, because you might say, okay, you know, I'm writing about this and complaining about it, but one of the things that I'm doing, I don't know if I would call it exactly concrete, but it's kind of more concrete than you might think, is that, as you know, the European Union has these new accession states from Eastern Europe, and one of the things that's very much concern is how the universities will be constituted and the ways by which one will evaluate whether these universities are doing a good job or not. And of course, Britain is always a benchmark. I mean, one of the things that, for those of you who don't know, all of these horrendous schemes that we have for measuring research and teaching are in fact incredibly exportable. Because one of the things about them is they're very clear. Right? They may in fact be destroying the institutions they're trying to evaluate, but the point is, they're very clear. They're very clear. And you know, the thing is that, you know, so you get something measurable, right? And the thing is, when we're talking about intellectual life and knowledge and all this stuff, it's all very airy-fairy. And if somebody can say, hey, I can slap some numbers on this, whoa, we're on board. So we've got New Zealand, we've got Australia, we've got the state of Florida in the United States, Iceland, Ireland, all these places, Thailand, all these places have adopted, to, you know, greater or lesser extent, some version of what we're doing here in Britain. Okay? What a nightmare, right? And so I've been on these various kinds of committees and things having to do with the accession states in the European Union, making sure this doesn't happen. Right? And the issue then, you know, and this is not to say you should not evaluate universities, but you have to figure out some way of showing how research feeds into teaching, which then has this larger public benefit that illuminates the society. In other words, you need what we would call, back in the 18th century, Priestley's days, we need enlightenment metrics. We need ways of measuring enlightenment, okay? And of course, you know, this is not so mysterious. I mean, in terms of what the model would be of this process. Because when you do get academics talking about the enlightenment mode, right, that I've just been talking about, right, we hear things like multiplier effects, right, in the sense that, you know, I put forward these ideas in the classroom, and then, you know, the students may not do so great on the exam, and they might, you know, they might not quite get everything I'm saying, but then down the road, 5-10 years, you start to see some things happening, things are transforming, and so forth, and so if you use a sort of broad, you know, long enough time scale, you could start seeing some multiplier effects that would then justify having done this in the first place. The problem at the moment is that in academic life, we tend to measure everything in the short term. So, for example, even if we're measuring the impact of research that's being published, right, it's within these 4 or 5 year cycles. And you know, for those of us who are working in the it's worth anything. And if you're, and if you're judging its value just as it were at the point of delivery to the journal, it's going to be very, you're not going to get a very reliable kind, long-term reliable measure of that. Okay, but that's nevertheless how we do things at the moment. There is no sense of longevity, there's no sense of, and there's no sense of scale either. Okay, so we're not really looking at how it impacts on the larger society. So, these kinds of things, though, could be addressed in principle. These are not beyond human imagination. Right? It's just that, in a sense, we've become very lazy in academic life. We sort of accept these kinds of constraints. They're kind of easy to do, in a way. You can count your publications. You can sort of send things to journals. Right? Whereas this maybe involves sort of a little more thinking, but it would be worthwhile to get involved in. You know, so those of you, one of the things that I would hope someday, and this is another thing I've been encouraging, is that we actually have specialized degrees for higher administrators in academia, which doesn't reduce that to just doing, selling soap. Because at the moment, as you know, our senior administration in academia tend to think of running a university kind of like running a factory. And often we have people who've had experience of both. Right? And so the point here would be to actually say, look, there's a different sort of administrative imagination that's required in order to run a university effectively that involves having this kind of vision about how you exactly measure intellectual impact and take into account this business of enlightenment and the integration of research and teaching. You know, I say all this because I think at the end of the day, this is a practical problem. This is a practical problem, as it were, of showing the effects. Because, as I've been saying throughout this lecture, one of the big problems of intellectual life is that intellectuals, they're very provocative and they make their moves in their day, but for some reason they don't seem to leave a trace. In what canon are they to be found? Right? I mean, that's the problem. And I think, in a sense, what I'm talking about now about measuring the enlightenment function of the university is very similar in this respect, that people, in a sense, sort of believe it happens. All of you who have ever been academics, I'm sure, believe it happens. But nobody quite wants to measure it. Nobody quite wants to kind of objectify it. I don't know why. Maybe because it removes the mystique or something. But it seems to me this is something that could quite easily be done. And in a sense, it's part of a sort of general, larger project. Namely, we have to make the history of intellectual life, the sort of trajectory of intellectual life, more publicly visible. Not, of course, intellectuals are publicly visible, but that there is an intellectual life. And that it's an intellectual life that's integrally connected to the university is something that has to be made more publicly visible. And I'm going to stop at this point because, in a sense, this is kind of a homework assignment for you. I look forward to hearing your discussion and your questions. One thing I should say just in conclusion about the character of the book. The book is called The Intellectual because it's modeled on Machiavelli's The Prince. So it's kind of if you've read The Prince, it's kind of history, philosophy, advice. It's all kind of put together in a way. And that's kind of what the book does. And in fact, the last third of the book has frequently asked questions about being an intellectual and the conduct of intellectual life. It is offered very much in the spirit of Machiavelli's The Prince, and no doubt I would be condemned, just he was as well. But with that, I want to thank you for your indulgence.
Well, there was enough provocation. Thank you.
Well, I mean, in terms of neoconservative thought, I guess, I don't know, some of you may have seen, maybe 6 months ago now, Adam Curtis did this documentary on BBC Two called The Power of Nightmares, where what he tried to do was to show the parallels between the neoconservative movement in the United States and the sort of Islamic fundamentalism, and actually looking into the intellectual roots of both of them. Right? I mean, that was the thing that kind of was quite gripping. But in a sense, the power of nightmares was the power of ideas. So in a sense, that documentary was very much a testimony of the kind of thing you were talking about. He didn't go back to Aron. Actually, Aron was much more on the left than the neocons are. I mean, when we're talking about the French intellectual environment, right, being left of Sartre isn't necessarily being a conservative, it's just being reasonable. Right, you're still a welfare state person, for example, if you're Aron, okay? But the point is, you are right in the general point, namely, that there is a kind of intellectual behind the neoconservatives in America, and that's Leo Strauss, okay, who is a real conservative in the sense that he actually believes in Plato's double truth doctrine. I talk about this in the book, the idea that, you know, for the masses, you got to tell them one thing, and then for the elite, you know, you tell them something else. And you have to have both stories running at the same time in order to have a well-ordered society, right? You know, Plato's the myth of the metals, right, where people are born into different strata. Leo Strauss sort of believed, you know, this is the way to go in the modern world because we're in such a complicated place where, you know, chaos could break out at any point. You got to make sure people are kept in their places, you might say. And that very much influenced the neoconservatives, because he taught at the University of Chicago. He was an emigre from Nazi Germany. He taught at the University of Chicago until the late 70s. So a lot of these guys, like Wolfowitz, you know, might be the next head of the World Bank, I read. God almighty. I mean, you know, the point is, all these guys, right, were in fact students of his, you know, in the 60s, primarily. So the general point is there. Again, I'm not saying that ideas don't have any impact, okay? But there's a sense in which that academic life today is really strongly discouraging it, right? And the point is, because we don't normally, if we were telling sort of a, you know, you mentioned initially the business about the intellectual history point that you like so much about my work. If you do a kind of intellectual history of the modern period, and let's say you talk about Leo Strauss as a figure, he's a kind of awkward guy to place, actually, in terms of the normal categories in which we talk about the history of politics in the 20th century. Because we tend to talk about it in terms of ideologies, where we're talking about Marxism and liberalism, right? And Leo Strauss isn't even a mainstream conservative in the way maybe Michael Oakeshott might be or somebody like that, okay? So he's a kind of hard guy to fit in the normal ways in which we tell intellectual histories, because his influence isn't primarily through other academics who kind of are following up his leads and developing his thought, but rather, you know, you might say laterally, right, going outside of academia and into other sectors of society. You see, and that's the thing that, in a sense, we're not really very good at tracking or giving sort of proper recognition to. And it's very it's a very challenging thing, because in a sense, when the ideas move from the original academic medium, because Leo Strauss was a guy who just wrote commentaries, basically. If you want to know what exactly the man did, writing-wise, right, this is a guy who did not write his treatises, you know, in the way, you know, John Locke or Hobbes or somebody like that did. Rather, he wrote commentaries on such people. That was his primary academic contribution. So you'd never guess, as it were, prima facie, just looking at the text, which are usually, again, the coin of the realm of academia, but this is the kind of guy who would end up having the kind of impact he ended up having, because the impact was being transmitted through the classroom in these seminars at the University of Chicago. Okay? And see, the thing is, how do you track this? We have to be sensitive that this is a translation of the idea from one medium to another medium to a third medium. Okay? And this is the thing that, in a sense, we really don't have a good hang-up, you might say. And it's one of the reasons why we end up losing the impact that intellectuals have in society. You see what I'm saying? I mean, because that, I think, is the important thing that we need to kind of get a grip on here. Because it's quite easy to sort of do an intellectual history where all you're doing is following people, writing about other people. It's just a history of footnotes. But that's not necessarily the history of intellectual life. There was someone that said, yeah. Yeah,
that's a problem.
It is a problem.
Why should you measure?
Well, it's a tricky thing because there has to be. This is where I think it's important to have a sort of way of demonstrating return on investment. Okay. But you know, I mean, there's a sense in which the multiplier effect in economics is something that comes from John Maynard Keynes, which in fact justifies things like deficit spending, where in fact, you know, the government is spending a lot on things, and one expects that there will be some kind of benefit down the road, but in the short term you're taking a loss. Okay, and in a way this is how I see the sort of subsidization of universities, namely. In the short term, if we're talking about 3 or 4 years, right, you shouldn't necessarily expect that all the money that's invested into them is going to be returned. What one needs to do is to look at a sort of a longer term thing. But then one needs to have a theory of, as it were, of the, you might say, the business cycle of the university, whereby the multiplier effect actually ends up redeeming its promise. I think that's something that in a way would be a very good project in social science to do, and I think it can be done. But I think, generally speaking, one has to be, as long as one can show return on investment, I don't think one should have to say, oh, we have to return exactly as much as we invested initially by a certain kind of date, as long as you can show generally that it does happen.
So the same thing has happened in the, you know, the art world, it happened in the intellectual and literary or philosophical world, in the sense that the connection between institutions, higher education, and museums, and curators, I mean, if you, you know, all the curators draw around the country will come from the Slade or all the World College of Art, and rather than and someone like Picasso, I mean, compare Picasso with Sartre, you know, somebody who comes to paint through this kind of galleries, and the galleries buy the work becomes very popular or becomes very and sells a lot. That isn't the way things work now. Yeah, I mean conceptual prices become like Brit Art, Tracy Emin. I mean, it's academic. I mean, it's what Duchamp did individually. I mean, Duchamp wasn't any a goldsmith, was he? Duchamp had left all that. Duchamp had thought all that up, went to America, you know, lived the way he did. Nobody lives that way these days. What you do these days is you academicize, Duchamp's ideas.
Yeah, sure.
And the kind of the curators of the museum,
sure,
then have lots and lots of money to buy those things. You know, they kind of legitimate you. And vice versa. And it's the same way in the art world as in the academic world. The second thing is why do you stay in the academic world?
Well, because actually I do have one of these institutionally sort of secure positions that actually, and I'm trying to actually do what I would like academics to do.
But is it possible today to be someone like Sartre in an institution? I would say it's not. And the reason why it's not is if you read the Critique of Dialectical Reason, it's not just a whiff. Okay? Right? It's a kind of a very high theoretical kind of
sure
work about the difference between analytical reason and dialectical reason.
Yeah.
Yeah? And the reason why you can't, I mean, I tried to do an MA on Sartre using dialectical reason. I mean, it's scientific exactly comfortable. Stuart Hall. Yeah?
Really?
It was failed. Because you can't use dialectical. No, it's fine. I mean, I benefited from that because I've learned it was an experiment. Okay, you know, you're in the kind of respect, having a type of experiment. You can't use dialectical reason in the institution. I mean, it means nothing, does it? What's dialectical reason? Hegel. I mean, we don't do Hegel, do we? We don't teach dialectics, do we?
No, but see, in a sense, Sartre is kind of he's a difficult example because Sartre wasn't an academic.
Precisely. Because he was off base, wasn't he?
Yeah, early on.
He was off base in America, right? Because the same reason why he started not taking the Nobel Prize is because he said it hampers my freedom as an intellectual, not in some academic sense, but in a real sense. You become part of the academic world. You've got then to conform to academic, not just topics, but ways of thinking.
It's a good point, but I guess I think you're asking me, right? I might be like the last Mandarin or something. I actually do feel I still have the freedom, okay? And I think you're right. It is a judgment But I take your general point. I think there is a real issue. But Sartre did pay a price, and I think that's worth pointing out. Right, because this was a guy who was always living on his wits, you might say.
And money, he's very wealthy.
Well, yes. But the point is also there was the business of actually trying to figure out where the next wave is. You could see from the man's life there was a lot of personal pressure to kind of perform in all kinds of ways, right? Because there wasn't this kind of institutional backdrop. I mean, because one of the things about academic life that I guess traditionally was kind of a form of solace was if you didn't have to produce on a regular basis, right? You could, in principle, and those of you who have historical memory about academia know this, right? People didn't always publish stuff every year. Right, you were allowed to just teach your courses and to develop things and to, you know, read stuff and that kind of. I mean, those you young people may be amazed to hear this, but this used to happen, right? And you still pulled the salary. You still and this is. It seems to me this was a very important kind of institutional backdrop against which intellectual life could flourish. Okay, so you know, and it's true. There are very few people who now can enjoy anything even resembling that. I mean, the reason why I survive the way I do is because I'm publishing all the time. I'm a nightmare. Okay, but you know, you shouldn't make someone's obsessive compulsion neuroses the standard by which academic life occurs.
You and Gray do the same thing.
Objection or even a lot of very very sort of rigorous thinking that kind of went into this at the outset. I mean, in other words, I really don't think academics have either, you know, have really put their minds to the issue of developing sophisticated evaluative measures for universities. This was something that, as far as I can tell, you know, with a few grumblings on the sidelines, just got sort of pretty much taken on board. Especially when academics were invited to participate in the process. And that was the killer, right? The killer, because the thing about this kind of audit culture that we live in academia, those of you who are in academics might not know this, is that we self-administer it. This isn't, because I think, you know, from a political and psychological standpoint, it would make a big difference if there was some bureaucrat in Whitehall, you know, actually doing the numbers and sort of, and actually going around to all the universities and figuring out what was good or bad. But the thing that really sold this was that the academics were able to select the people who were evaluating them. Okay? And so that was sufficient to buy the academics. And so there was no real serious discussion about whether the measures themselves that were used were really any good and whether they measured what needed to be measured. Because as soon as you enabled the academics or allowed them to participate in this government-sponsored thing, they said, fine. Okay? And so it seems to me there's never been... So I don't think from an intellectual standpoint this is such an insurmountable problem. It's just that the challenge has never been formally met. We just capitulated too quickly. I really do believe there is. I really do believe there is. I mean, because it costs a lot of money to administer all of these metrics, teaching, research, and the House of Commons has had a standing committee on this and to look into how much it costs. And my guess is if we actually go ahead with this one, and those of you who are part of it know that it's kind of been deferred a year, another year, so it's going to be a kind of longer period from the previous one, I think it's because it's going to probably be the last one because it's too expensive to administer, and the information that you get as a result of it is minimal. It's not worth the cost. My guess is that's going to kill it in the long term. It's going to be a purely economic argument without all this intellectual sophistication we're trying to get into here. I'm hoping at least that's what happens.
Well, this is an interesting point because the key to this thing, you want to say, is this multiplier effect.
Yeah.
But the multiplier effect, as you know very well, he's an economic.
Yes.
He's an economist.
We have to talk. That is the way in which it has to be dealt with.
But the economists don't know how to measure it. You forgot that no one has ever measured, no economist has ever measured in any reasonably accurate way the multiplier effect. It's some sort of a concept, which is a very good teaching concept, but when it comes to really applying it in a professional way, it doesn't have an answer. So
yeah, but Victor, look at what we use as metrics in academia. We count publications. We're doing really Mickey Mouse stuff at the moment, and we're basing our funding decisions on it. So, you know, the multiplier effect is kind of in the same league.
It's in the same league. No,
so it's not like we're doing anything more sophisticated at the moment.
It's a marvelous fiction.
Okay, so I'm
going to
try to...
I'll put it on there. First, second.
I agree with you on that. No disagreement on that. I mean, I do think one thing that makes a difference is that even though, I mean, and this, in a way this kind of counterbalances the point you're talking about, which is true. I mean, those of you who don't know, one difference between America and Britain is that people do specialize here a lot earlier than America. In America, often you don't have to declare a major till the end of the first or second year of a four-year degree. Okay, and even with the PhD, you don't have to declare a supervisor a topic until like a year or two after you're already in the program, right? So it's really that is a big difference. But I think the thing that in a way keeps that, at least traditionally, not anymore because Britain's becoming Americanized, but the thing that traditionally kept Britain kind of more general was the fact that the time you were actually in university was shorter. And I think that the business of dragging out university degrees where people are specializing for longer periods kind of kills a lot of general intellectual impulse. I mean, the longer the people are sort of incubating, you know, that is really one of the big problems, I think. And the problem is, of course, that it's just, you know, it's increasing in many ways. So even if you end up getting a PhD, then there's the post-docing period, and that kind of, in a sense, is regarded as a kind of quasi-training period itself. And this is where we get to the point of nobody having a regular post until they're 45 years old these days. You see, and that really does kill the kind of general intellectual life. Education systems do vary from country to country. I don't want to, and I'm not, and I hope you don't get the impression I'm somehow uniformly negative about the British system. It's just that were the things that are seen to sort of symbolize the British system abroad, which has to do with these evaluative mechanisms. I think these things are incredibly pernicious. But you know, you're saying about all these smaller universities and things that we've got in Britain, and the fact that maybe people become professor at a younger age. You got to look at this a little more closely, because we're also increasing the percentage of professors who are, as it were, in collapsing chairs, right? Namely, they have 6 years to kind of, as it were, start up a sort of self-funding base. This is especially true in a lot of the newer universities, where they expect the professors in some way to be, you know, integrally tied to industry and other kind of money-making things in the local community. And so they get like a six-year grace period where they're supposed to be developing these ties. And then afterwards, right, through their research units or whatever, they're going to end up being self-funding. Okay, so it's like seed money. That's how a lot of these newer universities see the professorships. And so, not surprisingly, you do get a lot of young, ambitious, kind of entrepreneurial, quote-unquote, type people getting into these kinds of things. But it's not professorship as we, you know, traditionally know it. It's really kind of like venture capitalism being done by academics. Okay. What?
It was Johnson.
Well, and so I think of Huddersfield University, for example, in Yorkshire, is very much of this kind. And if you read, you know, you read the Times Higher Education Supplement every week, there's always these stories, right, which in a sense are these success stories, you know, Derby is moving the world, you know, kind of thing.
Well, I come from Cranston.
Oh, okay. Go right ahead.
Jonathan Miller makes the point that in this country is also more an academic than
youth. An academic or an intellectual?
Oh, sorry, intellectual?
Yeah, that's what I thought. So academic, probably true as well. As a kind of social role, even though Britain is the most intellectual country in the English-speaking world. It seems to me quite obvious. I mean, anyone who's from America knows this immediately. I mean, those of you, you know, who have nostalgic or some kind of fantasy views about what the United States is like, forget it, right? If we're talking about the country as a whole, so, you know, people may think of America and think, oh, America, that's like the New York Review of Books, the New York you know, that's like, you know, 1%, if that much, reading these things, right? I mean, the New York Times is a subscription. You know, the 750,000 people in the United States read the New York Times every day. 750,000 people, okay? The Daily Telegraph has over 1 million reading it, okay? I mean, you know, so think about it. The United States has over 4 times the population of Britain, okay? So it's clear. It's just clear. If you travel around the English-speaking world, Britain is by far the most intellectual English-speaking country in the world. But you're right. There's this hang-up. And a lot has to do, I think, with relations with the continent and so forth, where intellectual is kind of othered as a Franco-German thing. But I think this country holds its own pretty well, actually.
Can I make a comment on this? Because I, look, talking from my own experience, I went through 3 systems. I started in France, in the French system, then in America, where I continued my afterthought. And then I taught here, in this country. So the 3 are extremely different, particularly the French and the Anglo-Saxon. In France, to be an intellectual is a badge of honor. Modernized in a sense, risky. But basically, in France, to be an intellectual was the highest status one could have. The professor at Collège de France, which is the highest institution of learning in France, which were professors teach their own research, not someone else's research, but their own research. Then when there are no students, and when there are no regular classes, all the lectures are given all the time. Professor at Collège de France, he is the social superior of the President of the Republic. How can he not? No question. Now, and a member of the Institute of the same about the same statute. In this country, from what I could see, intellectuals were not well regarded, and I can give you an example of a man at work, and when I said that you write intellectual history, I was just thinking, maybe I said something wrong, because this man ruined his career by writing intellectual history. He transformed his PhD thesis at Oxford into a phenomenal book, actually. And I could tell you, he was a member of this institution and one of the founding members of this institution. If I were alive, I could give you the anecdote. It's extraordinary. His name was D.G. Charlton, was the founders of the Warwick University and the founder of the Department of French. The book which he wrote is called Positivism, is about positivism of the intellectual history of France between after the French Revolution, from about 1820 to about 1870. Right? And a very great book. And the incident which I'd like to mention is this. I have known Charlton for a while. In effect, he was the man who came to this institution in one of its first meetings, when we used to meet at the Baltic Country Club, and said, we have to divide into groups, and I'm not getting out of this room unless you divide into groups. So finally, 2 people stood up and said, I'm going to take this, and another one said, I'm going to take the other. So I've known him then, and I met with him time to time, and I could tell you that I used to think that he knows about France what my old professor of English in France knew about Britain. Not very much, because he talked about generalities. We met, had coffee, and so forth, but we never talked about anything serious. So, one day...
and on that basis...
No, hold on. we'll come to the punchline. One day, I formed the literature and humanities group in November 1995. And Carl Charlton came to me and said, I heard that you formed that group. I'm going to give you a lecture. So I said, what is it all about? Well, it's going to be called New Wine in Old Bottles, French secular religions in the 19th century. You know, that's a marvelous subject. That's it. So he was going to give the lecture in February, going to the Canary Islands, and he died. He died during his stay over there, and when I heard, I went to his widow, and I asked her to, I know that he wrote a book or something, I all his colleagues came from Bristol, from Bath, from everywhere. It was very well connected. And I mentioned a few things, but now, in reading that book, I realized that this man has written something far superior than anything which is written by any specialist. Even Ray Peng Shu was a name who was very well known for this. He wrote a phenomenal book. Very, very interesting. And then I understood from his wife that he didn't write one, but he wrote in succession about four of them. And the four of them, one was more diluted. I mean, it was a sort of a gradual dilution. And he was finally called into administration. He became basically the head of the French department and became basically an academic administrator, which was a betrayal of very, very, very strong scholarly talent. And I remember asking his wife what happened, and she told me exactly this. Well, he wrote intellectual history in the beginning, and that was a very big mistake. So he realized it, and in order to pursue a career, he moved in another direction. So I thought for a moment. I also thought, and this is the reason for this institution, I think. I thought that how come Charlton and I met so many times in the cafe in the podium and talked about nonsense, and never meet. I was highly interested in the subject, and we never touched the subject. Why that? And I realized that what we need, what that kind of discussion cannot take place around a dinner table between the fish course and pudding, but you have to have a formal place in which to have intellectual discussion. And that is the basis of living. That's the basis of our own institution. That's how it happened. That's the basis. It was very clear to me that has to happen. That you have to have a place where this kind of, the kind of things which you're talking about tonight could happen. Because you can't have it over the dinner course.
No, I agree. I think no disagreement with you on that.
I will pass to you the Charles de Moore. You see how extraordinarily superior that was.
I vaguely heard of him, but yeah.
And you'll see at the end, if I give you his last book, you see that it's basically a dilution of the same book.
Huh.
It's the same, another version of the same book.
So, if any,
you
feel clearly the difficulties facing the intellectual, I'm wondering if you have any light to throw in studying the way in which universities sort themselves out or fail to. If you have any light to throw on the difficulties we seem to be suffering, on the one hand, our Prime Minister wants one citizen in two to go to university, and you might say the more you put in, the more steam pressure you raise the English intellect or the British intellect to achieve the university. And on the other hand, you say that it's being stifled. Can you describe the process?
In a sense, the pessimism that I have about the future of intellectual life in this country, and I think this is actually true of countries that are rapidly expanding the university sector, doesn't have to do with the society as a whole, because actually I think the expansion of universities probably does contribute positively to the increase in intellectual life. It's just it won't happen in the academy. So in other words, there'll be all these new students coming in, right? And they will indeed be enlightened, I think, and take whatever they get into whatever realms of life they go into, but I don't think they'll be particularly encouraged to do their intellectual work within the academy because of the way the sort of the incentives and the work habits of the academy, the way they've evolved to enable the scaling up to occur. So there's a sense, you see what I mean?
We don't mind where intellectuals are, the great problem is that we have. So do you think there is a hope that we shall continue to?
Yeah. I think the big problem with intellectual life is going to be within the academy. In other words, encouraging academics to be intellectuals. I think that's the real problem, right? I mean, but the students who take all these courses that we're giving, I actually think they're going to end up increasing the intellectual life of the country. I have no problem with that. I mean, I think the problem is going to be within academia, you see. Students aren't stupid. Students kind of see which way the wind's blowing, right? I actually think one has to give a certain credit to students for their savvy about these things. And I think students very quickly see kind of the shortcomings of the people teaching them and the sort of things that are motivating them. And then they take, especially since, even though, as we're being evaluated more, one of the things that we're not being evaluated on is having a lot of close personal contact with the students. Right, we have to have lots of them in our class, and we have to be marking a lot of papers and getting high marks. But actually, interacting with that actually gives a student a lot of space to kind of pick and choose what they make of all the stuff they're learning. And so there's a kind of space being given there. So I actually have quite a lot of hope that some interesting things will be coming out. And look, the fact of the matter is we've been in this kind of mill that we're talking about here now for what, 10, 15, 20 years maybe? And I think intellectual life in this country is doing fine. I think it's actually doing fine. It's just not good in academia.
The second question, I'm a child of the ethics. I wasn't sure why I misunderstood your comparison of intellectual writing with intellectual speaking. I rather felt that you were majoring, you were more positive about intellectual speaking than intellectual writing. Now, I just like to sort of test that out a little bit on two levels. Because on the one hand, you've said that the people that have been in academic or through academia but have not stayed in it, have gone into the media, kind of have gone into something which requires writing, opportunities to speak, but also writing publication, newspapers, and so on and so forth. And obviously, these academic skills wisdom, ideas that come out in that form. And you were very impressed with the British press,
yeah.
That it's positive and influential.
But television and radio too. I mean, I think we have to kind of look at this in the round.
But I don't think you were looking at the round. At least I misunderstood you. I thought you were sort of saying, really, academia at least needs more intellectual speaking. As I'm speaking to you this evening.
Yeah.
And I kind of challenged you now, partly because I can't speak intellectually in public.
You're doing fine.
Well, yes. But if you put me on a topic and I'm there, I'm finished. I'm thinking at the moment about the historian called Christopher Dawson,
who died
in the last century. An extremely shy man, and yet, sort of Cambridge, I can't remember which one, but one of his lecturers, when he was an undergraduate, said, I learned more about history from having Christopher Dawson in my time as an undergraduate than at any other time. Now, this man, I mean, he was an
sympathetic with what you're saying generally. I mean, I first ran across Dawson. My background before I went to university, I was trained by the Jesuits, right? And so Dawson was someone we read, and the thing was that he was seen as a very good, in a sense, as history as general education, right? Because he has the big picture, he gives you the big sweep, he gives you kind of like where history has a point, kind of thing, right? And that often enables you to write shorter books if history has a point, because then it's not just one damn thing after another, right? Those were considered quite virtues, because there's a sense in which the context in which we were learning history was, in a sense, very normative, right? It was a sense in which, you know, you're trying to get across a kind of perspective of what is right and wrong and how history kind of unfolds, kind of the options for you and the different ways it goes. But the point I want to make about that is, okay, he may not have been a very good speaker, but the point is the context in which that kind of history makes sense as something to write is a context of a general education teaching. It's a kind of, that's really the context where that sort of history makes sense, where you sort of like, history is moral instruction writ large. Okay? That's the context where it makes sense. And you start to get the enormous books, right? Though now, of course, they're very popular books these days. But, you know, if you go back to when you start to get the enormous books, it's when you're writing for other people who are writing enormous books. Okay? The German tradition, that kind of thing from the 19th century, when you have a lot of documentation and reproduction of archival material and stuff like that in your own text. But prior to that point, you know, the histories could be rather slim because, in a sense, you're doing it as part of a general education thing. And so in that context, the classroom does matter as a kind of site where knowledge is to be transmitted. Okay? So the fact that, you know, he didn't speak very well, in a sense, you know, nevertheless, there is still this context of teaching that I think is very important. And that's really the main thing I meant about the speaking, right? Namely, because look, no matter how shy Dawson was, being in a classroom talking to students would probably be the most comfortable context in which to impart this kind of knowledge, just because it would be in that context where you would have some sort of natural sense of authority.
More comfortable writing than he was writing.
What?
I think he was more comfortable writing.
Well, sure, he was more comfortable writing, no, but the point is that if you are the sort of person who is uncomfortable speaking, generally, in the classroom at least, right, there is a certain comfort zone because of the authority you bring to it as a teacher. And I think
you should remember that theories don't hold very well in history. To give you another example of a very speculative historian, Dawson was a capitalist person, but there is Toynbee. And Toynbee produced a 10 volume, very speculative work, a 10 volume history of law, which all of it has a point. And the point is carried out from one volume to another.
Yes. But he also wrote a small version where he stayed the point in one volume too. The opposite of that.
The abridgment.
Yeah. Oh, you mean the Somerville thing? Yeah.
Very difficult. Any other question? Sign some books and answer some more questions. I can we have a debate in our own institution about this business. Exactly what is the direction which we want to take, and what is our role in this intellectual or perhaps non-intellectual debate. And it's only fortunate that I invited Steve last year. Here, and it so happens that it came absolutely the right moment, because we are in the middle, the very middle of this debate, exactly what our role should be. And we have to think very seriously. Very, very seriously. So I thank you, because you helped us.
Well, thank
very
you.
Great deal.
Thank
not
you.
Only by mentioning the RSI on page 5, but that gave us the impetus of an intellectual institution together with Café Scientifique, but also because you clarified in our own minds, I think, a number of issues with which you have to put up. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, everybody.